You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
Welcome back to the podcast with myself, Owen Walker. In this episode, we're going to be speaking on the components of pre-hospital blood transfusion and indeed pre-hospital blood transfusion protocols with Adam Green. So what I want to do is really dig into something Adam's been working on for a while, which is the development of a national out-of-hospital transfusion protocol for critical care services. So we're going to unpack the recent modified RAND-Delphi study that sets out the guidance for clinical governance and recommendations for out-of-hospital transfusion services. So we're going to dig into some of the recommendations on the initiation of transfusion, the types of blood components and products, the delivery and monitoring of out-of-hospital transfusion, the indications for use, and indeed the transfusion adjuncts, and finally, the resuscitation targets to halt ongoing transfusion. So to do this, I have Adam Green with me. Adam is a unit chief and critical care paramedic working at British Columbia Emergency Health Service. He's also an honorary lecturer at Cardiff University on their Masters in Critical Care. Amongst other things, he's also recently published author on the development of this National Out-of-Hospital Transfusion Protocol. And it's this protocol which is going to form the basis of our discussion. Adam, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you very much. It's an absolute pleasure to join you and to talk on this work. So yeah, thanks for having me.
So can I just get you to initially speak to why this study needed to take place?
Wow. Yeah. So we've been transfusing here in British Columbia for nearly 30 years, but largely it was reliant on sending sites to have their own product, or it relied on us picking up product from one or two tertiary sites, which really precluded our ability to transfuse pre-hospitally. It was only done in interfacility times, was very laborious, very ad hoc, and just generally caused problems. So the evolution of that process led to, in 2019, what was the first paramedic-led out-of-hospital transfusion program here in Canada, here in BC. So that allowed us to forward deploy coolers filled with packed cells to at least one of our bases based in Vancouver. So what we did is from there, we started collecting data and evaluating the effects of that. And then that allowed that program to grow, to expand, not only to multiple bases across this province, but now also to multiple products, being that we're carrying packed cells as well as thawed plasma. So from there, this became just a really keen interest of mine. You know, by no means did I start this program. No, I was simply just a guy who latched on to the pack a few meters from the try line, and I took it across. This is something that had been in the works long before me, but I'd really developed this interest, and then it became a passion and eventually became my dissertation topic during my master's at Cardiff. And my thesis, or my dissertation, was around a service evaluation of what we've been doing for the last 3 years. From there came a series of recommendations. And the last of the recommendations to be implemented was actually the development of a national working group. Why are we trying to develop these processes in isolation or in silos? We're doing this in BC, the prairies are doing something different, Ontario's doing something totally different, and then the Maritimes are doing their own thing. It didn't make sense to me. Why don't we start having these conversations together and then start developing, you know, a national conversation and then potentially a national clinical practice guideline? So inevitably, those early conversations led to the development of CANPAT, or the Canadian Pre-Hospital and Transport Transfusion Working Group. And then from there, we've now published two, soon to be three studies on just who we are, what are some of the technical practices of what we're doing. And then this, which was led by some of the brain children in Ontario around trying to develop national consensus statements around this. So it was really necessary to try and harness all of the good work that's being done in all these provinces to start having a national conversation.
And to your point, actually, the standardization of kits, the standardization of protocols and decision-making compounds, because like you said, there's healthy baselines of safety, healthy baselines of practice, and then you can start to aggregate like for like data. So let's just start with clinical governance, because clinical governance is the foundation of safe practice, and it's got patient safety at its heart. So I guess a question would be, could you speak to the recommendations for oversight and clinical governance within the protocol? What are some of the key principles in the protocol for governance that are denoted?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I take it back a step farther and sort of suggest to the listener that here in Canada, especially, the transfusion of blood products or blood components is one of the most regulated medical procedures we offer. This dates back to, you know, some blood contamination that happened in the 80s, and as a result, really led to a lockdown around blood components and blood products outside of very, very strict parameters. So the mere fact that we're able to have these conversations points to the structure and process that needs to be in place. So we started looking around at all the provinces and what are we doing, and knowing that this is incredibly regulated, we put hemovigilance at the center of this conversation, this idea of impeccable blood stewardship. So we looked at this to say, okay, well, what are the easy ones that we can cross off the list? What's the low-lying fruit? Okay, there should be no transfusions that are ad hoc. There should be a clearly defined protocol or clinical practice guideline that outlines how this is done. This is not something that needs to be random or varied. It needs to be fairly structured. Okay. Next, we then identified this can't be done by one group. The TM folks don't necessarily understand the trauma side of the house. The trauma side of the house doesn't understand what we're doing in the out-of-hospital environment. The out-of-hospital environment doesn't understand what goes on necessarily in the ICU. So it necessitated a multidisciplinary team. So what we did is we built this group around pre-hospital, out-of-hospital subject matter experts, critical care, eMERGE, transfusion medicine, trauma, and surgery. So that was one of the other recommendations that we put forth, was that any clinical practice guideline that is developed needs to have input from all those stakeholders, and it cannot be done in isolation. From there, then, we really tried to focus on what are the principles of damage control resuscitation. Unfortunately, the last 20-odd years of war in Iraq and Afghanistan have really led to further developments and advancements in damage control resuscitation, to the point where we're starting to bleed that conversation into non-traumatic hemorrhage, to say, okay, well, wait a second, we're doing X, Y, and Z in the traumatic population because we have, unfortunately, way too much experience. But what are we doing now in GI hemorrhage and in obstetrical hemorrhage and in post-operative hemorrhage? Is there some lessons that we can learn here so that we're not trying to develop six ways to administer blood products to somebody who's bleeding, because now that's where you're ripe for errors. So what are these common themes that we can apply to hemorrhage control? Okay. From there, then we looked at trying to be pragmatic, recognizing that the out-of-hospital environment is one of the most dynamic, unpredictable, and unforgiving environments that you'll face within healthcare. Things need to be pragmatic. There has to be a degree of give. What are the absolutes? What are the nice to haves? What are the, okay, if we can, we'll do it. So we then tried to write our clinical practice guideline and our sort of protocol with that in mind. What are some of the other key ones here? We wanted to have designated leaders within each system that we can funnel information to, or if there are questions associated to what happened, whether that's a QA or QI issue, we have a point of contact. So it's not everybody pointing fingers at each other going, oh, well, it's John over here, he does that part. And oh no, it's Tammy over there, she does that. We need to have one point of contact so that if there's an issue with blood transfusion, we have somebody we can talk to. So those are really some of the real, you know, the key points around clinical governance that we set out for. And then the last one, and I hate to say the most important, but because it sort of goes without saying, but the ability to audit what we're doing. We have to be self-reflective. Every transfusion needs to be looked at for, you know, was this appropriate? And what can we learn from it? How can we do better? So I think those have been the core recommendations from a clinical governance and a general oversight perspective.
Let's just dig into that for a second, because like you said, patient safety is at the heart of every intervention we do, and certainly this one. And the report and or protocol really does denote that there should be reporting of near misses and or adverse event reporting to look at compliance, but also just share information for when it may have been suboptimal. Could you speak to that? Because I think there's real that transparency and vulnerability from a system saying, look, we didn't get the tracing right, maybe we didn't get the administration right, maybe we didn't call optimally, maybe we didn't do something optimally, can be shared, that shared learning. And I think when one service does it, the reciprocity and the benefit to other services saying, actually, yeah, we recognize there's a default here, and these kind of never events or near misses. Could you speak to that?
Oh, you know what? I completely agree with what you're saying. And I would add in the idea of cultural safety as something that needs to be promoted. And when you peel back that patient safety and like that PSLS learning system idea, near misses, adverse events, and even events that cause harm are grossly underreported. Why are they underreported? Well, it has to do with the weaponization of these types of events. So we have to sort of peel that back and recognizing that there has to be a psychological safety. I have to be able to put my hand up and say, I really screwed up, and not face disciplinary measures for that. Because as soon as that happens, you will lose the purpose. This has to be one where it's like, ooh, you know what? I totally mucked up here. But let's peel that back, you know, another layer and say, I have to be able to say I've made an error in the interest of patient care. To say, you know what? Well, something's happened. What's gone awry? These are also not something that we do frequently and commonly, and there's a lot of nuance to the procedure and to potentially the issues. And I mean, even the, you know, we'll talk about later, but around the indications, they're not clear. It's one of the most, trying to identify the bleeding patient or the exsanguinating patient is actually very challenging. So, you know, to be able to put your hand up and say, you know what, I mucked that one up. He wasn't bleeding. This was something else that I misinterpreted. How are we going to learn from it? And being able to essentially do a PDSA cycle on each transfusion to say, this went well. How do we put that back in the equation to optimize what we've had? And essentially just allow that ad hoc review process to happen in addition to your structured yearly reviews of what's gone on. So I think all those bits are really important when it comes to patient safety.
One of the fundamental aspects of a blood delivery system, or indeed a protocol, is keeping blood cool. Could you maybe speak to how the protocol denotes keeping this as an essential part of the safe delivery system?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this goes back to something I was describing earlier, which was around hemovigilance and ensuring sort of optimal stewardship of blood, and that idea of cold chain is vitally important. It's been demonstrated to be possible in the extremes of temperature in Iraq and Afghanistan by the military. And now what we're facing is the opposite, the extremes of temperature of Northern Ontario or Northern British Columbia. So when we look across Canada, every system is using one transport cooler, which essentially is an insulated box that uses the vacuum sealed cooler that is then individually temperature monitored. So they're all validated to the predetermined limits, typically between 1 to 6 degrees. And then there's a time limit associated to how long it can keep something within that temperature range. And that's anywhere from 72 to approximately 124 hours, depending on external circumstances and temperatures that it's exposed to. So interestingly, something that we learned consulting with the Canadian Armed Forces was when they deploy a cooler into the heat of Afghanistan, it doesn't stay at room temperature for the entire duration that it's out of the lab. It goes into the cooler box. That cooler then goes into a refrigerator that's typically at 2 to 3 degrees. And then they only pull that blood box out when that helicopter or team is deployed to a casualty. And then as soon as it returns, it goes back in there. So its actual exposure to temperature extremes is a lot less. So what's interesting now is, so when we first developed our program, well, we didn't have the same extremes of temperature that you see in Iraq and Afghanistan, but we stored our coolers, and actually all teams within Canada, they store their coolers at room temperature. So typically 21, 22 degrees, and we weren't having temperature variances associated to that until the heat dome of 2021. So here in British Columbia, when we had that, when we got baked in temperature for probably 3 weeks, we saw temperatures in the 40s for prolonged periods of time with, even at night, it was not getting, you know, below 30 degrees. What happened was we lost 4 units of product. But going back to our previous conversations around like adverse events and near misses, well, we treated those incredibly seriously because now that's product that we've lost. But what do? So we evaluated the events surrounding that, and then we made recognizable changes. So because of that, we're the only team in Canada that we follow the Canadian military model, where when our coolers get delivered to us at our base, they then go into a refrigerator. And then we pull them out when we deploy them, and then they go back in. And it's a way that we can try and extend their out of laboratory time. So, okay. So, I mean, that's a very long-winded way of saying we use a fancy cooler, and this is how we're trying to mitigate some of the temperature extremes. From there, we use internal temperature monitoring. So we use what's called a temp tail, which is a laboratory grade temperature probe that sits within the box and actually in between the units. And it, once it's turned on, it records the temperature in, don't quote me, 3 to 5 minute intervals for the duration of time. And then you can essentially graph it. So you're able to determine whether that has gone outside of its predetermined temperature range. And I mean, so for an example, just 3 weeks ago, I was out on a mission during the day. It was quite warm in the 30s, and we had opened the box to transfuse a critically ill trauma patient. And I was like, ooh, 9.1 degrees. So I'm now within 0.9 degrees of these products being expired. We haven't done anything different. We haven't opened the box. We've taken appropriate care of this, you know, life-saving package, and then it's almost expired just based on our daily activities. So I managed to retrieve one unit, get it all sorted, close the box, and then we need the second unit. Now I open it up, it's 9.8. So I'm now within 0.2. So interestingly, I shared that as a near miss to the folks at TM through the technical network, and they pulled the data logger for that cooler because we wanted to see, well, was it an issue with the cooler? Perhaps the actual vacuum insulated panels are starting to wear out and they're not holding their cold zone long enough. So they pulled that and we looked at it for the entire duration, the 72 hours that it had been issued. And what it showed was it was consistent 4.5 degrees the whole way across. And then as soon as we opened it, big spike, 9, and then immediately drops back down again. So that temperature spike was solely related to us opening the box in an extreme environment for less than a minute. So just very interesting that the susceptibility that these products can have to those temperature extremes. And then sort of the other bit that we're seeing, so we talk about cold chain, but it's also critically important that we, you know, it's going to sound silly, but we don't lose any of this stuff. This is not like a Sager splint or something else. It's like, oh, I don't know where I put it. I can just go grab another one. Like this is something, it's, you know, this is a transplant. Somebody has donated a portion of them for use in you know, potentially a life-saving intervention. Like you have to take this so seriously and be so respectful of this incredible gift that somebody has given. So we then took it a step further and say, okay, well, we're going to put GPS trackers on this, and we use Apple AirTags, and they're linked to our phone, and we have a little proximity sensor, like a little geofence around our phone to the cooler. So we know that if we're ever separated from that cooler by more than, I think it's about 30 meters, it alarms. Take your cooler with you. So those are the types of steps that we've implemented to ensure that sort of cold chain. And as I said, that hemovigilance around out of hospital transfusion.
So let's go there with the recommendations for use. So the, you know, what you'd use to initiate blood products. There is subtle nuances, as you said, there's maybe no standardization. And I think to make it even more difficult, you do have concomitant physiological pathways happening. So sometimes you have a vagal response to pain. You went to a hugely challenging road traffic collision, MVA, the other day. And patients may have multiple systems. So they may have a vagal response to a mid-shaft femur fracture, but actually also might be losing blood into an open pelvis, or indeed into retroperitoneal bleeding. So it's full of nuances, but could you maybe just delineate some of the decision making and or trajectory that you see and that maybe worries you that you start to initiate blood?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think as the audience, you know, is probably widely aware, like the results of sort of PAMPER and the COMBAT trials, they really form the basis for a lot of the positive evidence around out-of-hospital transfusion. But what we started to find was that when you started looking more closely at the data set, it's that those intervention-based differences, they're most likely during longer transport times. So greater than 20 minutes. COMBAT showed us that, you know, if you're exsanguinating 6 minutes from the hospital, getting a transfusion versus getting to the trauma center, you need to get to the trauma center. The blood's not going to benefit you. So 20 minutes was sort of that mark where we started to see intervention-based differences. From there, then there's been numerous secondary analysis of that PAMPER data set because it's been it's of such high quality and has been made widely available for research. So they've attempted to isolate what is that specific population that is going to benefit from this, recognizing that, you know, what is the optimal timing, ratio, and even who gets it. So they found that, you know, it's now more beneficial in blunt trauma, those who have co-committent traumatic brain injuries, those who have moderate transfusion requirements, so less than the designate massive transfusion. They use, you know, more than 10 units in 24 hours as their delineator, but those who just require moderate transfusion requirements. And then they also found that when plasma was administered with packed cells, that was better than just single products by themselves. Okay. So that really formed the basis for what we did. Fast forward to 2022 and everything went into the snow globe. The results of the refill trial came out and they cast a lot of doubt on sort of the generalizability of out-of-hospital transfusion. But they also, you know, they still had that slimmer of hope that there was this distinct phenotype of who would be responsive. And that's what we're still trying to figure out. So fast forward now to the panel that we've created here in Canada. And really, the panel attempted to balance what is the evidence base with the pragmatic out-of-hospital environment and to allow for some degree of flexibility, okay? So recognizing that, you know, there's multiple scoring systems out there, there's algorithms that can be used, there's all sorts of things that can predict when somebody will require a massive transfusion. None of them have particularly high sensitivity or specificity, so there is no unicorn. There's no one that's like, that's the one. They all have some pro and con and where are we at? And there's really just a degree of nuance. If we look to arguably the highest performance HEM system in the world, London, they use something called the Hateful Eight, which is this like conglomeration of signs and symptoms that they've come together, but also just using a whole lot of clinical gestalt. And that's really difficult because clinical gestalt makes it now makes QA and QI more challenging. So that's probably where we face is, how do we write a clinical practice guideline that fits within paramedicine that allows the flexibility to still do this, but still maintains patient safety at its heart? Here in BC, we have we use our transport advisors as a point of contact. So we have a very firm statement within our clinical practice guideline that you will not transfuse somebody without talking to somebody first. And it's this idea of not mother may I, but let's talk about this case, recognizing that there is inherent risk and complications with every unit that we transfuse somebody. Does this person warrant it? Does they need it? You know, is the case sufficient? You know, it's like the Senate, little sober second thought. Yeah, okay, that makes sense. No, you know what? Is there another component here that we're missing? Is there another shock state that could be contributing to this that's being overlooked? So that does vary across the province, where you see Ontario, for instance, doesn't have that same requirement. They have written a clinical practice guideline that their transport advisors are satisfied that somebody doesn't need to make the phone call to. And I'm of mixed minds. I admit I haven't reached a state now where I've called for, you know, to discuss a case with a transport advisor and haven't gotten what I wanted, because it's around how one presents the information. But I've had some really good discussions and set up some parameters. And it is one of the parts of the system that I do appreciate. The caveat, of course, is in a province this large, 1 million square kilometers, and with limited resources, especially transport advisors, I can't always get a hold of them. So now I face this ethical conundrum of, holy smokes, they're bleeding in front of me. Could be the most obvious exsanguination imaginable. Can't talk to somebody. What do I do? Well, I mean, we know where we're at. So that's a conundrum we face right now, is how do we overcome those? And that's what we're working through here in British Columbia, is how do we protect patients, provide support for paramedics, but also provide enough flexibility, recognizing that cell service in this province sucks. So
just, and you make a really good point there around using other people as guardrails, Adam, because, you know, to be able to bounce ideas off and indeed another person's gestalt, albeit over the phone or indeed over a radio, whereby you can just, you know, give them an S-bar and get maybe and hopefully an objective opinion on whether they needed an out-of-hospital transfusion. But just moving through and looking at the sort of ratio of 2-to-1, so plasma to red blood cells, could you maybe speak to the evidence that giving more plasma improves survival?
Well, so that's an interesting question for sure. So as a panel, we felt that there was insufficient evidence to make a strong recommendation around balanced transfusion. Although the use of plasma in the pre-hospital retrieval setting is most likely beneficial. We found there's strong agreement to balanced transfusion, but it's difficult to standardize that approach when accessibility is limited. We don't want to make a statement that says everybody needs to have plasma, recognizing that 6 of 10 provinces can't provide that. Well, now they're providing substandard care. That's tough. So what we felt was that a specific recommendation around ratios was probably outside the scope of this document, but would certainly be entertained further. We then, you know, we came back and had quite a vibrant discussion over a couple of meetings, and really felt that the results of the proper trial, which showed no difference in outcomes between 1-to-1 and 2-to-1, was probably where the best evidence lay currently. So, you know, let's take it a step farther and say, we, instead of focusing on ratios, we wanted to focus on sort of the larger aspects of damage control resuscitation, instead of just one. And yes, plasma is widely stocked around there, but its availability is limited here in Canada. So what we said was, we're not going to come out and say, you know, this is our recommendation, but if it's available, we absolutely support its use and think that is, you know, the way forward until something like whole blood is to gain Health Canada approval.
So Adam, could you speak to the delivery of out-of-hospital transfusion as the majority of patients will be uncross-matched? Could you maybe speak to maybe the signs and symptoms of hemolytic transfusion reactions that are potentially seen in the field?
Yeah. So with, as I've suggested earlier, transfusion of blood products and blood components is not benign. It's far from it. And transfusion reactions range from relatively common to sort of benign, febrile, non-hemolytic reactions to rare, severe hemolytic transfusion reactions, trialy, taco, things of that nature. So what we emphasized was pre and post vital signs of every patient. You should not be transfusing somebody without it. So they need to have pre and post continual monitoring through the transfusion, as well as temperature monitoring, as deviations in temperature are often one of the first signs of transfusion reactions. And then recognizing that almost all out-of-hospital transfusions will be uncross-matched, that delayed hemolytic reactions need to be watched in hospital. So essentially, you know, declaring that this person's had an out-of-hospital transfusion, and so that eMERGE staff or ICU staff are aware of this so that they can carry on the close quarter monitoring that these people require.
So just looking at sort of a package of care, Adam, certainly in the traumatic bleeding patient, you know, TXA, the adage of TXA and or calcium, because I think, you know, the intravascular or indeed intracellular calcium gets mopped up when blood is given. Could you maybe speak to what a package of care might look like for the trauma patients? Sort of maybe standardization of giving TXA and or calcium together with blood.
Oh, absolutely. I really like the transition now from the triangle of death to now the diamond, which includes hypocalcemia as one of the detrimental sides, particularly within trauma. So, you know, to your question around bundles of care, you know, we know the early administration of TXA, it's shown to reduce mortality in traumatic and obstetrical hemorrhages, with its effect gradually decreasing over time, and 3 hours being that sort of magic mark where risk outweighs benefit. Similarly, we know calcium is an important within the clotting cascade. We know it's an inotrope, and we know that hypocalcemia is common in patients with trauma. And as a result, there's a linkage to an increase in mortality. We, as if you suggested there, packed red blood cells, they're preserved with citrate, and citrate naturally binds with intracellular calcium and can cause and exacerbate sort of hypocalcemia, particularly when they face large volumes of blood product transfusion. And that's not unique just to red blood cells, but you'll also see that within plasma as well. Very interestingly, and probably new 2 weeks ago, actually, I think I sent it to you too, there's a recently published article from the German Trauma Registry that actually identified this parabolic relationship between ionized calcium levels in major trauma and outcomes, suggesting that hypocalcemia was as detrimental as hypercalcemia. So really that poured a lot of water on this idea of just empiric calcium administration. So what we've suggested was calcium should be administered for every 2 to 4 units of blood products that are being administered, or if you have a identified point of care value that suggests they're hypocalcemic. So I think that's probably the most appropriate. That's more challenging. We have the availability to do point of care testing here in British Columbia. We're very fortunate that way. But when you look at our registry, less than 50% of cases have a pre-hospital blood sample drawn just due to the logistics. Whether this patient is, you know, there's so many things going on with limited hands and limited priorities, or, you know, in you know, a case I faced just a few weeks ago, it was so warm when I went to pull my monitor out of its case, it was too hot, wouldn't turn off. Well, sorry, wouldn't turn on. It says it's outside of its temperature limits, so I can't actually do this. So, yeah, so that I think the bundle of care is very key. There's no one intervention that is critical. It truly is around a bundle of care. But something we haven't spoken about is this idea of this is all fun and dandy. It's still definitive hemorrhage control. This is of no value if they're actively bleeding and we haven't controlled it. So whether that's, you know, through compressible hemorrhage or through the rapid prioritization of transport to definitive care for those non-compressible hemorrhages.
You make a good point.
Pouring in blood products into somebody who's got a big hole in their system. It's not useful.
Well, you make an excellent point, Adam, around restoration of normal physiology, but also, like you said, just the recognition of its limited utility, because it's not necessarily going to be the definitive treatments that this patient needs, especially in non-compressible hemorrhage, whereby you need a knife and or a surgeon to get to the point of bleed. But could I get you to speak to what you're looking at, maybe some nuanced endpoints or otherwise, when you see blood product working? What are the sort of markers of normalized physiology to sort of quality assure quality assure over time? Because like you said, what you want to do is map data across time to see, is this intervention working? Is it working as a bundle of care or as a separate intervention? What are the markers in your mind?
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. I guess to start that off to say, there's considerable uncertainty as to when to stop or even reduce an ongoing transfusion. So much like data points that we acquire through an assessment, what we've settled on is it needs to be supported by multiple data points, potentially over multiple periods of time, to show a reasonable trend. As we all know, that one individual blood pressure value may be inconsequential or just inaccurate because there's so many things that could factor that one. But when I factor that in over, hey, I got two values here, but when I also factor in, oh, what's their heart rate doing? Well, their heart rate started to trend down. Okay, fair enough. Where's their lactate? Okay. What is their hemoglobin? Although not a great measure of somebody who's early exsanguinating because, well, they don't typically just exsanguinate red cells. They exsanguinate whole blood, base excess. And then we just start looking at end organ dysfunction, like, you know, especially in the patient that we get from what we would know as a hospital intercept or like a secondary transfer, somebody who's already made it to healthcare would be like urine output, signs of cardiac ischemia, you know, even their level of consciousness in those who don't have concomitant traumatic brain injuries. So really it's this idea of like, just got to look at the big picture and where are we at here? And there is no nuanced way that says, oh, hey, their blood pressure is over 90, we stop the transfusion. Great. Their heart rate's still 150. They've lost 3 liters on the ground. Okay. Like there's everything. I mean, this is going to go to sort of a larger point I have around like individualization of care. I think the cardiac arrest community is on to something when we look at what is the individualized care. You know, we're not trying to target one specific map, because the map I require to perfuse my brain may be a lot less than the map you require or my wife requires. And it's trying to understand that and not put everybody into the same box, because what's going to happen is we're just going to harm some, we're going to over-resuscitate others, and our actual measured effect or benefit is going to be kind of small. So yeah, a long-winded way of saying it depends. We need multiple data points over multiple sets, and we need to look at the bigger picture of the patient.
So as we come into land on the conversation, Adam, and we just look at the adage of this protocol and the benefit, there'll be quite a few critical care schemes in multiple locations listening to this, thinking about embedding blood protocols within their service. Could you maybe speak to a few points, a few sort of salient take-home messages around how and or when they could start to introduce blood products into their services?
Well, I mean, number one, I think you're giving us a lot of credit. This is the Canadian way, and we're trying to do something here in Canada. So what are the salient points? The salient points are almost counterintuitive to the whole discussion we've had it's still rapid or expeditious transport to definitive care. No amount of pre-hospital intervention is going to fix if you cannot control the hemorrhage. And what we want to prevent is protracted scene times to try and start an intervention when what they need is a surgeon. So I think that's really important to recognize that this needs to be done with the idea of moving towards definitive care at all times. That needs to be the goal here. From there, I think we also need to appreciate that we always strive for perfection. I don't think that there isn't perfection here. We have to accept a degree of, okay, we're doing our best and we're learning as we go. So I think that's also really important. Demonstrate that so many people before us have all shown that this is feasible and in many different systems and with many different complications. So if a province, a state, another country was looking at this to say, okay, this document, this is a starting point to the conversation. This is not the end point. Okay. This is a starting point. Look around the environment, like do an environment scan and try and identify the country, state, province that best mimics where you're at and ask them how they've implemented it and how it's working for them. I think that's probably a really interesting point that we're seeing forward is when you're looking at generalizability of how we do this, find the one that fits your system. Don't take this as gospel. This is not. This is one version that's worked for us in our circumstance. But I could take this down to Montana and it's going to fall on its face, hypothetically. And then the last piece I would say is if you have questions, just call us, ask us. We'd love to share. Be more than willing to help and share our experiences. We are by no means the experts on this, but this is what we've done to this point. And our larger stakeholder group is satisfied that we have the best interest of patient care. We have the best interest in being a good blood steward, and that we have a robust QA and QI program that allows us to learn from each transfusion.
And Adam, I just want to say thank you actually for the last 45 minutes. I think what we'll do is we'll put the study in the show notes just to make sure that listeners both here in Canada and further abroad can reference the RAND study, Delphi study, and just look at, like you said, the fundamental components of a blood protocol, and indeed either replicate it or alter it according to service needs. But it really is a fantastic and indeed insightful study. So both thank you for both your reflections over the past 45 minutes and indeed for writing the study.
Well, I was part of a much larger group that did write this, so I appreciate the accolades, but I have to share them with the larger group. This was an incredible team effort, and we're very fortunate to have the group we have here in Canada.
No, that's fantastic. Thank you, Adam. And we'll definitely put it in the show notes. I'll also put a link to for people to contact you by email if they want to share reflections and or ask you further questions, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.